I'm looking at Airbnb listings for Kansas City, which I've never done before because I live here. But it is kind of crazy. You can stay in someone's third floor guest bedroom in Pendleton Heights for $29 a night. And this doesn't appear to be like a sketchy situation. The host, Brett, has glowing reviews. Clean bathroom and linens with plenty of essentials. The glass bottle of tap water was a nice touch. Great place to stay on a budget. No need to go out for drinks. Self-service bar downstairs with beer and liquor menu. He even welcomes travelers with dogs. So, pretty hard for a hotel to compete with that. But also kind of weird to think about what that means for Pendleton Heights. A hidden gem of a neighborhood in the historic Northeast where even savvy travelers probably would not have ended up a decade ago. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking Airbnb in KC. Is the in-home hospitality service changing your block, your neighborhood? Call 816-235-2888. Tell us what you see. That number again, 816-235-2888. Let's turn to David Hudnall with the pitch. Hi, David.
Hi, Gina.
So, what might the presence of Airbnb mean for a neighborhood like Pendleton Heights, just for example?
You mean for the neighborhood at large, kind of?
Yeah.
I mean, I think what you could see is, I think maybe one of the concerns that people have about Airbnb is that it can kind of change the makeup of the neighborhood, where places that used to be long-term rental units are now being rented out for short-term rentals like Airbnb. And
why would that matter to anyone other than the person living in that house?
Well, because it depletes the housing stock in the city for people who want to live in the city full time, and it can drive up the rents that remain or of the housing units that remain.
So you see people actually purchasing property in order to
as a business,
yeah,
as opposed to, I mean, that, in some cases.
And then, I mean, people have done that for ages with the idea of long-term rental. Like, that's just the definition of a landlord. But this is different. How is this different?
Well, it's different because it lowers the housing supply for people who want to live full-time in this city.
And so then the shortage or just the supply issue makes the cost go up?
Yes. I mean, it can, yeah.
So right now there is a proposed ordinance being looked at by the city council to regulate short-term rentals in Kansas City, because right now, if I understand it, renting out your place on Airbnb technically isn't like quite legal.
It's not legal. So there's a city law where you can't rent. You're technically not allowed to rent something for under 30 days unless you're a hotel or a motel. But while the city kind of...
So there are just 750 listings on the World Wide Web.
That are purely legal, yeah. But the city has sort of decided not to enforce that law while this kind of ordinance wins its way through the local governments and they iron out, you know, the details of how they'll regulate these things moving forward.
But what's the story behind this ordinance? Who brought it? Who's behind it?
I mean, I think it's just a recognition that that Airbnb and other of these short-term rental platforms are spreading across the country, and other cities are having to deal with them. And you know, we now have somewhere between 500 and 750. So it becomes a thing where you have to figure out how to grapple with this new kind of strange thing.
What is it exactly that needs to be grappled with?
Well, I think you have to, I mean, so taxes would be one thing. You know, you mentioned hotels and motels earlier. Like, I think if, you know, hotels, the cost of a room, taxes are something like 16%, like, tourism and convention taxes and sales taxes. And so, you know, hotels and traditional bed and breakfasts also, would argue, you know, we're having, you know, this is built into what we can charge for our rooms, and it's unfair for us to have to compete with these other things that are basically doing the exact same thing we're doing, but don't have to charge for any of that. Also, you know, those hotels, motels, bed and breakfasts are also subject to regulation, ADA compliance, health department inspections, things like this, which Airbnbs are also not. So it's a further burden that makes for a less level playing field when all of those entities are competing for the same visitors, basically.
There are also concerns about how neighborhoods are changed. Can you talk to me a little bit more broadly about those concerns, maybe based on what people have seen in other cities?
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe an example would be useful. So let's say if you're a professional, you know, you're a lawyer or a doctor and you want to, you've got some extra money, you want to buy a house as a rental investment. And whereas before, maybe you would just rent it out as a 12-month typical lease, so you buy a house in like the Volcker neighborhood and you can make $1,000 a month if you rent it out as a long-term rental. Well, now maybe you could, if you rent that thing out as a short-term rental and you can get $150 a night, 10 nights a month, then, you know, you're making $1,500 a month. And, you know, if you rent it out half the days, you're doubling what you were making before. So it's a pretty easy, you know, and that's not necessarily, I think, what's happening everywhere, but if you can make that happen, of course you will. Most people, I think, would turn that house into a short-term rental.
But are people making that happen in Kansas City, that scenario where it's
so
like
I don't
every
see,
night? That seems
well, no, I don't think that's happening every night. But I'm saying even if you're getting 10 nights a month, that's you're still, you know, up ahead. So, and I think in other cities, and so I don't think that Kansas City has this problem yet. But I think you see in other cities, particularly tourist destinations or larger kind of, you know, your Portlands and Seattles and Austins and whatever, you're seeing.
New Orleans comes up a lot when you
New
read
Orleans,
about this.
New Orleans, I think, is a real mess right now because you have these entire neighborhoods, because it's such a tourist destination. And, you know, you could probably make, you could make your monthly mortgage payment during like one night in Mardi Gras. And what you see is that these neighborhoods that are adjacent to, I think in the French Quarter, it's been like pretty severely restricted, but the neighborhoods that are adjacent to it are sort of being hollowed out because it's so profitable to rent those houses as Airbnb. So you have real estate speculators snapping up houses, paying inflated values for these homes because they can make so much money on the other side of it. And so it's sort of, I mean, in some way, I think in New Orleans, it really is destroying the fabric of some of these historic neighborhoods.
By hollowing them out, you say?
Because there's no longer a community there. You know, it kind of looks like a community. It's kind of this weird, I just recently stayed in New Orleans in the Marigny, and it's kind of like, it's sort of, it's almost like kind of, it's like postmodern or something. There's some kind of like illusion of authenticity to it. Where it doesn't really feel like, you know, it feels like you're staying in a real neighborhood, but then like there aren't really any neighbors. And
where you realize that the people next door are also from
somewhere else. And so it's like, it's kind of this weird experience. I think that's an extreme version of, you know, what could happen, but I think it's something that nonetheless does happen.
I was going to say it's kind of hard to imagine that happening in Kansas City, but I would also say the last couple of years in Kansas City, a lot of things that I would have said were hard to imagine happening here seem like they're starting to happen, like the way that rent is climbing in certain neighborhoods, the way that downtown feels different, winning the World Series.
Yeah.
You know, like there are just a lot of things that just because it seems hard to imagine doesn't mean it couldn't.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think you know, as articulated by like the mayor and a lot of our community leaders and, you know, local boosters, like I think there's this idea that we want Kansas City to be this kind of millennial friendly tech hub full of artists, blah, blah. And, you know, that's maybe not the most original idea in the world, but it's, you know, it's a vision, right? And I think the city kind of is behind that idea. But if you like take that to its logical end, that basically means that, you know, we become something like Portland or Austin or whatever, which are cities that are now having some of these problems. They're having affordable housing problems for sure. And I think in some of those places, you see Airbnb exacerbating that problem.
So you went to a city planning commission, you wrote about this, where they heard testimony on this ordinance. And it sounds like there were a lot of people there to weigh in. And you've broken those people down into some of hilarious categories. We have Airbnb evangelists warning of a millennial creative class apocalypse in Kansas City if the city moves ahead with regulating short-term rentals. Tell me more about that voice.
Well, I just think it's this kind of, Like I use Airbnb. I'm just trying to give the full view. But I mean, I think that there is kind of a sentiment that the city has to totally get behind anything that smells like a new tech idea. And
Airbnb smells like a new tech idea.
Well, I mean, I think we have to be welcoming to this new platform that's allowing, you know, that is truly allowing people to make extra cash on the side, or, you know, creating new kinds of business opportunities.
And allowing something for travelers. I mean, use it. What is it that it gives
you? Well,
it's
cheaper and more convenient. And I think people are always going to use the things that are cheaper and more convenient. I just think that
it also lets you kind of visit a city feeling a little, maybe it's not real, but it feels a little more like you're there living the life you would be living if you lived there, or something like that.
I totally agree. I just think it's like, but do you feel good if you're in New Orleans? How do you feel about the fact that your time is basically displacing a community that's been there for a long time?
Right. Yeah. Not good.
And so that's where I think, you know, I think that's where government has a role to play in this stuff.
You also have this category of people, neighbors of current Airbnb locations, who are sick of loud parties.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's kind of I don't think that's a huge concern. That's not something I hear a lot of people have concerns about in terms of Airbnbs, but I don't know. I heard a couple of people say that at that meeting, so.
And bed and breakfast owners who want to see a level playing field, as well as representatives of the hotel association.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like I mentioned before, it's, you know, they feel like they're offering essentially the same service as an Airbnb, and they feel like they should, you know, Airbnb should be taxed accordingly and regulated accordingly.
What do you think is at stake here?
I think it's about the future of housing and whether there's going to be enough units in cities, in popular cities, for the people who live in those cities to survive. I don't think that's happening here yet, but I think that probably there should be more conversation about, you know, how we would handle that if were it to happen. Because, yeah.
Well, let's talk with someone from Airbnb about this. Laura Spangin, good morning. Laura, are you there?
I am, yes. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
How does Airbnb typically work with local governments to deal with the kinds of concerns we've just heard?
You know, that's a great question. And thanks for the discussion earlier. I think, you know, there's sort of two issues that I think came up in the discussion you just had. One is around regulations, and the second one is around taxes. I'll start with taxes first, because that is important to people, right? Paying taxes. So cities get the money that they're owed, and hosts are doing what's legal. So for us, you know, for Airbnb, hosts are supposed to pay the taxes, right? Every host is supposed to remit the occupancy tax to the city or the city or state. And we've encouraged our hosts to do that across the country. What we have found, though, is that it's very difficult to do that. One, they either don't know that they're supposed to do it, or even if they do know, it's very complicated, or the city can't accept their tax because we're, you know, a slightly different beast. So what we did is create a whole new tax division where we actually take the responsibility off of the host, put the tax responsibility onto Airbnb, and we pay the tax. So we collect the tax from the guest when the guest checks out, just like a hotel does, and we collect all that money, and then we remit it to the city and state. So we really want to do that in Kansas City and Missouri. The issue with Kansas City that makes it difficult is that there's a law in place that rooms, and this goes for B&Bs too, if you're less than 8 rooms, then the lodging taxes are not due. So we're trying to work with the state of Missouri to change that, so that we, in essence, will contribute to the tax base and pay that full tax. You know, we've done this now in about 300 jurisdictions across the United States. So we really, really do want to pay our fair share. So there's that issue.
Yeah, I want to jump in. David, is there anything else that would change as like a side effect to seeing that law changed? Or is it just something that's been on the books forever and no big whoop?
It sounds like no big whoop. I mean, I think it's just a state law that they got to get fixed. And I think that there was hope it was going to happen this year, but it didn't happen for some reason. I mean, as long as Airbnb and others aren't lobbying against that law, then I see no reason for that it would not go down.
Laura, I mean, Where do you live? What city are we talking to you from?
I live in Houston, Texas.
Is Airbnb a major presence in Houston?
It is. It is. We just had the Super Bowl earlier this year. And so we had a lot of new hosts join the platform. But Houston is one of the largest cities for Airbnb in Texas. Houston and Austin.
Do you see Airbnb changing neighborhoods there?
I don't. You know, I think that, you know, this sort of idea of Airbnb changing neighborhoods is a little bit of a myth. You know, you brought up New Orleans, and I worked in New Orleans extensively. In fact, I was practically living there last year when we were working with New Orleans on a tax agreement, which we have in place now with New Orleans and the state of Louisiana, and a regulatory structure that just went into effect this year, earlier this year, a few months ago. And we studied the issue and really tried to understand what, you know, impact Airbnb was having on issues that were brought up earlier, like neighborhood character, like rental rates, like housing stock. And we found, we did studies, we hired professors in New Orleans to do studies, and we found out that they're really not having an impact on increased rental rates, nor are we having an impact on affordable housing. The amount of Airbnbs in New Orleans, for example, was about 1.8% of the entire housing stock in New Orleans. We've done similar studies in Seattle, Portland, and it's usually anywhere between 1% and 2%. So it's not, even though it seems like it's having an effect on some of these cities that are very popular, they're popular for other reasons. They're not popular because we have a lot of Airbnbs. So to deal with the second issue, which is kind of neighborhood character and people coming in and buying up a lot of a stock, right? A lot of housing units and renting them out. I think that there was an issue with certain neighborhoods being impacted by probably that issue. And so we, of course, wanted to work with the city to ensure that wasn't an issue. We don't want to be part of problems in cities. We only want to, you know, we want to be part of solutions, and we want to help people. I mean, most of our hosts are either rent out one house or two. They're mom and pop operators, and they use the money to make ends meet, save for retirement, send their kids to school, et cetera. So the folks that are taking advantage of this and that are doing it more than they should, we want to work with cities to try to stop that if it's an issue. So New Orleans, the regulation we put in place is that you can't rent out a second unit more than 90 days a year. And so it doesn't allow for you to come in, buy up a bunch of properties, and rent them out full time,
Laura,
because of this new requirement.
Can I jump in and ask you, I mean, as someone who works for Airbnb, I know that you are going to tell us the good, and that's what we wanted you to do. But is there something that you'd be willing to acknowledge we would want to look out for as we shape this ordinance, shape this governing, you know, process, how Airbnb will be regulated in the interest of our communities and our residents?
In Kansas City,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Kansas City, you know, really hasn't, and I think that was said earlier, has not reached the levels of what some of these other cities. I mean, in New Orleans, there's about 5,000 Airbnbs, and the city is probably less population than Kansas City. In Kansas City, on our platform, you've got about, you know, you don't even have about 600 units. So it's a much smaller community. And, you know, we want to ensure that we continue to be responsible hosts, right? We haven't seen really any issues. We haven't seen issues around neighborhood character changing. We haven't heard issues of nuisance or neighborhood complaints around parties. I mean, we haven't really seen any issues in Kansas City. So to ensure that that continues, right, we want to work with the city on regulations. We have been. We've been talking to staff, talking to council members. Representatives have spoken at many of these meetings. We just want the regulations to be fair and reasonable. We want to pay our fair share of taxes. And we really want to be good partners to the city and just be, you know, and have our hosts be responsible and great members of Kansas City.
Well, Laura Spangen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll hear your stories about Airbnb and KC after the break. We'd love especially to hear from people who live near Airbnbs. 816-235-2888. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about Airbnb in Kansas City. There's a new proposed ordinance that the City Plan Commission and the City Council are kind of hammering out right now that could affect how Airbnb works in our city. And so we're hearing about what is at stake with all of that. We've been speaking with David Hudnall from The Pitch. Hi, David.
Hi, Gina.
And now I want to talk to Chelsea Boren, who's an Airbnb host with a place near Westport. Hi, Chelsea.
Hi.
We're going to get to your calls in a moment. Call us and tell us what you're seeing at 816-235-2888. So, Chelsea, tell me the story of how you became an Airbnb host.
Well, my fiance and I moved to Kansas City about 3.5 years ago, and we bought a foreclosure, and we fixed it up. And we had a lot of space we didn't know what to do with, so we decided to use some of the extra bedrooms as Airbnb as a way to meet people and also to make some extra money to help pay our bills.
And what were some of the sort of early surprises in that process, would you say?
There weren't a lot of surprises. Honestly, we really quickly started hosting people in our home and made relationships and loved the people we were hosting and loved the amount of variety of people that came in from all over the world.
Describe your home and maybe what you had to do to it to get it ready.
Okay. Well, when we moved in, it was not livable. So we had to get a brand new kitchen, brand new bathrooms, paint on the walls, new floors, the whole thing. So that took about a solid year of renovation. And then after about a year of going hard on renovations, we had it livable. We felt like it was able to be open up to host people and to get a roommate. And so we were deciding whether to get full-time roommates, long-term tenants, or short-term at that point.
So you really were in a situation where it's like, are we getting someone to move in here? So is this a space for Kansas City people, or is this a space for travelers passing through?
Yes. We actually got 2 long-term tenants at first, and then we have our house is a 4-bedroom home. So we had 2 long-term tenants ourselves, and then we had an extra bedroom. So we decided to turn that into short-term rental to kind of get the best of both worlds there.
What's it been like for you to meet people passing through or to just interact with people visiting the city in this way? Have you learned things?
Yeah, absolutely. We've hosted people from about 16 different countries at this point. There's all different kinds of people and ages coming through our home with different intents to visit Kansas City. There's people that are moving here or just coming to explore or here for concerts or weddings or family reunions. There's every type of person you can imagine coming through our door.
How often would you say you have people in your Airbnb?
I would say right now it's about 90% of the time.
That is so surprising to me.
Yeah. Most of the time, if we decide we don't want people, we just block the calendar for a couple of days just to take a break. But it's booked out most of the time. I think we're in a pretty hot area for people to visit. We're located right in Midtown, so you can pretty much access all of the main amenities of the city.
Do you have a sense of whether you have a lot of other neighbors who are doing this too? Do you interact with other Airbnb hosts?
Yeah, absolutely. I helped manage some Airbnbs for about a year. I managed 13 properties. So those are all within neighborhoods. But there are definitely some new Airbnbs in my specific neighborhood that have opened up in the last 6 months or so.
Do you think that does have the potential to change what the neighborhood feels like, for better or worse or neutral?
I think a little bit, yeah. That's why I'm very pro owner-occupied Airbnb, because our situation, we have that extra space in our home that we want to share with visitors, and we kind of want to be ambassadors for our city and show people the places we enjoy eating and the places we enjoy shopping and the parks we like to explore. So it does change a neighborhood a little bit, but I think in a really good way if you're using owner-occupied more so than non-owner-occupied, because it's really kind of selling your city or showing the positives about the city.
Let's talk to Beth, who's calling us from Columbus Park. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
What can you share with us?
The house across the street is a duplex. It's been an Airbnb about 9 months, I would say. And I think it all depends on the owner.
Wait, but what have you experienced with the one across the street?
You know, there's only been a few instances. Once he had a tenant that had parties and left trash in the street, and you know, in 9 months, that was one time. One time during a Big 12 conference, a woman, and they were very drunk, and they got locked out, and they came knocking at my door late at night, you know, because what do you do when you're at an Airbnb? There's no resources. There's not a concierge anywhere.
Yeah, you've just got to go waking people up in their homes.
Right,
Yeah.
Right. So that was a funny experience. We let her in and gave her some hot chocolate because it was cold.
That's nice of you.
But otherwise, I think it depends totally on the owner. And there is an issue with trash because they have much more trash than a normal household. And
wait, why is that?
That's more people in and out, I guess. You know, each time somebody leaves, they put trash in the bin. So right now, even though the trash just came this morning, there's still trash all over the street there. So
I guess, yeah, that is something that we haven't talked about is the absence of the kind of staffing you would have at a hotel that kind of cleans up after travelers behaving badly. People of all kinds can behave badly, but I guess when you're away from home and anonymous, maybe that ups the chances a little. Is that something people talk about, David?
I haven't heard too much about that. I don't know. Have you?
I can see that a little bit with non-owner occupied, definitely. I have heard that. There's not that need to take care of a home as much as if you're in somebody else's home where they're on site. And that's what
you feel like a guest.
You're a guest in someone's home. You're going to respect the space. But if you have that entire home to yourself, you feel the freedom to kind of leave messes or be loud late at night. But personally, I've never experienced that because I'm there.
I've experienced the reverse with an Airbnb where the tenants' friends were partying late at night and one of them tried to stumble into the wrong apartment. It was awful.
Yep.
She came walking right in through the sliding glass door. Beth, tell me about how long have you lived in Columbus Park? And do you see, it sounds like there is an Airbnb across the street from you, but I wonder if you have the sense that your neighborhood being close to downtown, being one of those kind of quickly gentrifying neighborhoods, could change because of this.
Well, I'm at the very end, so I'm not seeing it here yet at the end towards the highway. So really it hasn't affected my block except for the one house.
Okay. Well, so Columbus Park, largely unaffected except for the occasional late night visitor needing a key and hot cocoa.
Well, I don't know about the other side of Columbus Park, but on this side, yeah.
Thank you, Beth.
Okay.
Now let's talk with Jamila. Is that your name?
Yes, Jamila.
It's nice to talk to you. What do you want to share?
Okay, well, I'm a law professor at UMKC, and I research and write about short-term rentals. I specifically write about discrimination in short-term rentals, but also local government regulation in general. And one of the things that I want to caution against is too much state control with regard to how localities regulate Airbnb and other short-term rentals. I heard the woman from Airbnb saying they're working with the state with regard to collecting taxes and maybe even changing the tax scheme in Kansas City. And I want to caution against that. I think that it's important for local governments, for neighborhoods even more so, to have a true say in how the how short-term rentals are regulated in their own localities. Kansas City is not Columbia, it's not Jeff City, it's not St. Louis. And so Kansas City should decide how Kansas City regulates short-term rentals. I happen to be from New Orleans also, and so that's a whole nother, that was mentioned by one of your guests, that's a whole other situation and should be regulated on a neighborhood-by-neighborhood basis, district-by-district. The French Quarter, of course, is different from Uptown and the like. And so one of the things that I just think is really important is that local voice and not things like state preemption.
What is really at risk with state preemption? I mean, can you give me an example of a situation where that ends up working against a particular community with a particular need that doesn't necessarily match what's going on in broad strokes across the state with these kinds of situations?
It could be any number of issues, a limitation on the number of days that a host can host. Could be the needs are different, say if you're at Lake of the Ozarks versus in a neighborhood in Kansas City. So that might be different. The impact on neighbors would be different. And so we have to hear from those neighbors, but also hear from the hosts and what their needs are. So a vacation area is different from an inner city neighborhood. And so that's the sort of issue that I'm speaking to.
Gotcha. Well, thanks, Jamila. Thanks for calling.
All righty. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You know, one of the things in the ordinance, unless, I mean, I know they've been changing it. Maybe this has changed. But last I knew, there was talk of getting approval from, I think it was 3/4 of your immediate neighbors before being able to set up shop.
Yeah. And then the new version, they've dropped that down to, I think, 55%. And that's if you, that's only if you, I think that's only if you live in a residentially zoned neighborhood. I think that's if you live in a non-owner occupied, if it's a non-owner occupied, which I think the threshold on that is 90, if you rent it out 95 days a year or more. So basically if you're not living there.
Chelsea, do you think that that's something that would be a major hurdle, or do you think that that's a good thing to make sure that you've got, I don't know, that, 3/4 of your neighbors at least are on board with this?
I think that's a good idea. Me personally, I'm in an owner-occupied, so I don't believe I have to get neighbors' approval, but I'm not quite sure on that. But as a non-owner-occupied, I think that should be the case. I think the neighbors should be aware of how well this is ran, and if it's not ran well, then they should have the right to not be okay with it.
Yeah, and I think you see in some other cities, like I think that there's a city in Colorado that, you know, they made it so you can only have 2 per block, per city block. Like that's one way that they've tried to make sure that, you know, entire neighborhoods don't kind of get run over by, you know.
Let's talk to Steve calling us from Midtown. Hi, Steve.
Hi. My wife and I have done short-term rental in the historic Heritage House of our Midtown Hyde Park home since 2009. We've done over 420 rentals. We've had people from all over the United States, and I think 5 or 6 foreign countries, zero problems. And I'm also very actively involved with the city and a group of about 25 people that do short-term rental in writing the actual ordinance that you all are talking about. And I know the specifics of it, and it actually deals with every question that your callers have raised. And I think people need to look at the actual ordinance. Kansas City is going to be a leader in this area because they're going to have a wonderful short-term rental ordinance.
Well, thank you so much for calling. And we're out of time, but Chelsea Boren, David Hudnall, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, we shall not be moved, whether it's a department store in 1960 or a football field in 2017. How civil rights protest has and hasn't changed on KCUR's Central Standard. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're talking about a new production at the Coterie called We Shall Not Be Moved. Artistic director Jeff Church, good morning.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Glad to be here with these fun actors.
And we are going to turn to your actors in a second, but give me the synopsis of this play.
This play is almost like a documentary play, but it also has a world of people that were around the Greensboro Four in 1960 when these college freshmen at A&T College decided to, after taking a seminar with Martin Luther King, they decided to do the sit-in in Greensboro and to protest the Jim Crow law at the time of only whites could be served at a lunch counter. So we are doing that story in the community around the protest action and the community response to it at the time.
What made you want to stage this play now? I mean, how long has this been in the works?
Well, we've been staging a civil rights or social justice play for the last 4 years. So this builds on that previous conversation.
The timing is just eerily, I don't want to say perfect, because in some ways it's just, it's sad.
Right.
How resonant it is.
We feel the same way. You're talking about Charlottesville and recent eruptions in St. Louis, and even, you know, this weekend with, you know, Take a Knee and people having all different points of view about a protest. People not understanding the NFL protest speaks right now to our play. I'm looking at the actors are nodding because we all are thinking about in the play, there's all these different points of view about whether whether and how and should you get involved in a protest, and whether parents should be allowed to stop their kids from being in a protest if they want to. That's a big topic in our play.
Well, let's go ahead and talk to the actors. I'm here also with Darrington Clark and Crystal Coppedge. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for joining me. So, Darrington, you play the young man. Tell me about that role.
Young man is a really excellent role to play in this show because he acts not only as the setup of what you're going to see, but he also sort of moderates and facilitates the conversation that is happening between the play and its audience.
And because there is audience involvement.
Absolutely.
Can you explain that a little more?
Well, something that the Coterie has liked to involve in its social justice slot is this ability to have a discussion with the audience and really engage them in this forum aspect of audience participation. So we get a chance to sort of stop the show, per se, and while we all still remain in character, get to ask the audience questions or engage with them about what they've just seen. And it's amazing the answers that you can get night to night.
Well, we'll hear about that in a second. But Crystal, you played Deirdre. Who's she?
Yes. She is absolutely, I want to say, like, very strong and spearheaded towards wanting to change. And very determined that her peers also are the same way and that no one distracts them from doing that. So
she's kind of a ringleader.
She is sort of a ringleader. In a way. And she sort of provides this conflict for another character in the play that kind of fuels this thought of kind of like what Jeff was saying, who should participate, when should you participate in protest and how. And so she kind of brings about those thoughts.
What had been your relationship with those kinds of thoughts and questions before working on this play?
Interestingly enough, I resonate very well with Deirdre because she, to me, is a lot like how I would be. Like, yes, we have to do this. We have to change something, despite other people saying, like, no. And there's a naivety about it. Just like, oh, I think that this change is going to happen now. And sort of like, wait, it's going to take time. And it's going to take work.
So there's like,
and it may be hard.
Naive and maybe like youthful impatience.
Yes. But absolutely.
You say that this is how you would be in this historic time, but as we've already indicated, we're living in times
right.
where these questions come up for people all the time. Do they come up for you?
Absolutely. Even with my own parents, there have been protests here in Kansas City that I have gone to, that my husband has gone to, that we've even taken our son to, and they've been very much like the parental
concerned.
Yes, like in the play, they were like, "Whoa, are you guys are going, and you guys are taking your son, and are you sure this is the right thing to do?" And we've always been like, "Yes," and so yes, in a way, it absolutely parallels with my personal life.
Darrington, is this personal for you as well?
Absolutely. I think, like you said, it's creepily accurate, this play that we're doing and the time that we're doing it in. And even though perhaps the challenges that we are facing are not quite as in your face, not quite as pressured as companies saying that you cannot eat here, the way in which we go about instigating those changes remains the same. And what I love about our play so much is that the heart of it really is that young people especially have the tools and the power and the inspiration to enact these changes, no matter what time it is.
How did you relate to the civil rights movement and that history before this play?
When I learned that I was going to be doing this play and I got a chance to read it, I started researching and completely fell down a rabbit hole. Not only just about the Greensboro Four and what was happening in North Carolina at the time, but all of the different sit-ins and movements that had come before.
How old are you, by the way?
I'm 24.
So, yeah, this is a long time ago to you.
I mean, relatively perhaps, but in the grand scheme of history, this was very recent. And because we're still dealing with a lot of these things, it feels very contemporary. I think one of the things that our cast noticed after putting it all together and having a run through is that it didn't have to be set in 1960. It didn't feel period.
Right.
A lot of it.
Is there something that looking at it at these questions through the lens of history has changed for you as you look at current events, as you hear about something like protests on in Columbia at the MU campus. I mean, I know that happened before you were working on this play, but does it change your perspective?
It changes my perspective in that it is interesting to look at young people taking a stand today and the ability for us to have been able to do that this entire time. There's always the opportunity to stand up and make things right. And what it's really about, again, why I like our play so much, is recognizing that and recognizing that you don't have to stand by and idle if you feel that there's a change that needs to be made. It's hard, but it is something that you can do now.
Crystal, have you had that experience of coming home from working on the play and looking at the news and being like, wow, there's a dialogue going on here?
Absolutely. Very recently, there was an article in the Kansas City Star. I think you guys, you all interviewed Aaron Randall. He wrote this amazing, like, put together this amazing article just about this divide that's in Kansas City with professional Black people and socializing. And I remember reading it, and I was sitting next to my husband as I'm like scrolling through, and I'm like, this is absolutely what we are portraying in the play, in so many close ways.
Mm-hmm. Can, like, you explain that a little more in case people haven't read that article or heard the discussion we had on the show? I mean, just what it was, the kind of segregation.
Absolutely.
That is
right.
So essentially the article was about this segregational divide in Kansas City when it comes to particularly millennials and Black millennials professionals in the Kansas City area and wanting to socialize, wanting to go out, but they're not being places for them to do that, where they can connect with people like them and just different cultures. And like, there's this push that's wanting to keep these people away, keep us away from certain areas. And so instead of, like, in 1960s, you're saying, like, absolutely no Black people here, no people of color here. Now it's, these are things that people of color like. Well, those things aren't allowed here. So it's
hip-hop being the biggest example.
Right. And it's so it's underlined now. But I immediately recognized it when I read it, and I was like, what? This is incredible. Like, before I could even think of a game plan of, like, what are we going to do, I kind of was taken aback because it was so relatable. And I almost couldn't believe that we were dealing with it in 2017. I almost couldn't believe it. Like, mm-hmm. we are portraying these young students at these sit-ins demanding to just have the same thing, to just be able to live and thrive. And here we are in 2017, and I'm having the same desire. I just want to live and thrive and have the same things, have the same opportunities. Again, eerily, mm-hmm. like, very creepy how that is such a parallel.
As you talk to students, because the Coterie's audiences are often young audiences, the target audience is 11 and up. That's a pretty young starting point. And it's interactive, as we've established. Can you talk to me about some of the conversations? I mean, Darrington, I'll start with you since you're mm-hmm. moderating some of them as the young man.
Yes. The Coterie employs and deploys teaching artists who will go out to certain schools and provide a workshop so that the students can be very prepared and equipped coming in to discuss the show. But a lot of the audiences that we receive perhaps don't get that workshop. And despite people having the opportunity to do that or not, I'm consistently amazed with the responses and answers that we will get from students, especially when they come see the show. Anything from asking really deep philosophical questions like, where did segregation come from? To specifically targeting some of the characters in our play and asking what your motivation was. Why did you act the way you did? It forces us to keep on our toes and make sure that we have done our research and know our characters. But even more so, it's so interesting and amazing to see them engage and ask these questions that they should be asking of themselves and other people in their lives.
Have you ever gone home from the theater and felt sort of like you're still thinking about what someone said, what one of the students said, and feel maybe even challenged by it in some way?
Every time.
Can you give me an example?
There was one student who asked a question. I wish I could remember the exact phrasing, but it was something like, why didn't you trust in the Lord that everything was going to be all right? And it was like, there's no mention of specific religion of any kind in our play, but for whatever reason, that was something that had occurred to her. And it made me start thinking about the culture and, like, what we present and what that looks like to young audiences. And I went home and I thought about like
just how people's different backgrounds might shape what the options are that they might perceive in a situation.
Well, and the connections they make and how they view these situations. And I mean, again, it's just going back to engaging and having a connection with them, and like what they pick up and lift out of the script is awesome.
What about you, Crystal?
So recently we had a question, the question, when did segregation start? And a follow-up question from another student at the very end was, when did segregation end? And so I think we all kind of like looked at each other because we go over questions and we go over sound bites that we would do, right? But this was like a question that like we all were like, wait. So we're still in 1960, essentially, when we're answering the questions. But these students are in 2017 still in their head in a way. And so for that student to ask, well, when did segregation end? Bears this question like, if it really did end, would the student be asking when it ended?
Right.
And so we were all just kind of like stuck. And then we were like, well, it you know, it hasn't yet.
You're like, it's 1960s.
It's 1960s. It hasn't yet. But I think the same answer would still be if we went to 2017 and we were at that time, we would say it still hasn't yet.
That's right.
And that's scary. That's a little scary to tell the student, it couldn't be any more than 12, to tell them it still hasn't. And so you still have to pick up this torch and fight.
That's right.
Jeff Church, artistic director, you staged another play last season. It was the
Nine Who Dared.
Yeah.
About the Little Rock Nine.
Right. How has the sort of interactive aspect of that play compared to this one? Has it been, because two things have happened. A year has gone by and this is different content. But I'm wondering if those things have brought out something different in the students and their responses.
Well, I think that the forum, we get better every year with how the community interacts. And so I think the forum, we've gotten a lot of compliments that people really are satisfied with the engagement. But the thing that I keep coming back to in my mind is that what happened in Little Rock...
with the desegregation
with
of schools.
With the desegregation, the leadership did not understand how complex that would be, and they really didn't have a strategy beyond let's try to integrate this high school with nine kids in a high school of 2,000 people. And that's not how we integrated in Kansas City, by the way. We had people in the audience that explained every performance, practically, somebody would say, I lived through this. I can tell you what they did. They did one class at a time. So the freshman class would be integrated. And then
had people who were able to tell the stories.
Absolutely. And it's so beautiful when we had somebody who was at a lunch counter on our second performance of the current play who said, I was the lunch counter busboy. I was this. And the actor who played that role jumped off the stage and shook his hand, and the guy was just amazing. But I will say that what the Little Rock, the difference between Little Rock and this group and the Greensboro Four, there was a real strategy. They had sit-in rules. We pulled out the sit-in rules and we compared them to the flyer handed out in Charlottesville, which was how do you deal with white supremacists? And that set of rules and the sit-in rules were darn near the same.
Wow.
Parallel.
It exactly was really, really crazy.
I'm kind of getting shivers thinking about that. You know, you've talked a lot about the decisions that different characters in the play have to make, and I wonder if you can just take me to a moment as we go, like the kind of decision we're talking about.
The decision to choose between if you're going to allow things to stay the same or if you're going to stand up against something that could very well kill you.
It's a big decision. I'm getting nods.
Well, yes, we agree.
Our time is up.
Thanks,
so,
Gina.
Yeah, Jeff Church, Crystal Coppedge, Darrington Clark, I've really enjoyed talking with you all today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We Shall Not Be Moved is at the Coterie in Crown Center. It runs through October 22nd if you want to check it out. You can listen back to our conversation at kcur.org Central Standard. If you missed the earlier discussion about Airbnb and new proposed regulations on short-term rentals, that'll be there too. KCUR.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, who are the real leaders of Kansas City? We're not talking about the mayor and chief of police and directors of major philanthropic organizations. We're talking about the people who are buzzing around beneath the surface making things happen. Tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.